Brian Dawson, CEO of 1819 News. What's up, my friend?
Just another day.
You're the first CEO to ever come in this year. Well, I guess Tony Gump's the CEO of Vaporforge.
Technically, I would be president, not CEO.
Okay. Presidente.
So you are the first CEO to ever be on this podcast, which is probably something we never thought would happen because we're not, like, serious people.
Yeah. Well, so, you're welcome.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. We need more important people on this podcast. Yeah. So far, we've done Scott Beeson. We had David Lynam, who's a comedian, and we're trying to get Larry Sinclair. So that's kind of where we're at. That's where our standards. Yeah, would really suck.
Get it? What I did there?
It sucks for somebody. But yeah, thank you for hanging out with us, man. Everybody knows that you guys at 1819 partner with us at 99.5.
Yes, sir.
Which I don't deal with any of the behind the scenes stuff, but I was always a big proponent for. Hey, let's get some local guys on the station doing local. Because when we got to this weird spot where we were left without a news department, we had some people leave and everything, and they had us running, and this is a corporate thing, they had us running ABC News.
Yep.
And it was like, Trump bad, Joe Biden good. Like
every hour.
Yeah, and we're doing conservative radio, and then at the top of the hour, here comes ABC, and they're like, Orange Man bad. And so, I mean, the listeners would just hammer us on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I ain't got nothing to do with it. I would actually make it a point to come back from breaks and make fun of what our news said just to kind of offset.
Sure.
And be like, I don't agree with that, but.
What's interesting, when I was talking to Val about that, I won't go into the whole thing, or maybe I will, I don't know. But how I came to be anybody in the media business is I worked at USA Radio Networks, and they had USA Radio News, top of the hour news. It was 5 minutes, and they targeted at AM news talk stations. And at one time back in the 80s, USA Radio News was like, you know, it was a big time thing under Marlon Maddox and everything. They had like 800 big stations, da 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 da. You know, back when AM was the, you know, where to be. Well, it ended up dying. By the time I got there, they were on about 200 stations, and I was driving around Alabama listening to country western music because that's what I do, and I would hear ABC News, CBS News, and I'm like, oh
yeah.
Surely these God-fearing rednecks down here in Alabama listening to country western, listening to old Hank, don't want to get their news from, you know, CBS and ABC. So I went back to the news team, and I'm the FNG at this point, right? I'm the friggin' new guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go to him, and I'm like, hey, I think there's some opportunity here, because we had a shorter news thing. Now, the problem was the production on USA Radio News sounded like it was done on a Casio keyboard. But the news itself was actually really, really good. My friend Russ Jones was the vice president of news. He hired really good reporters that knew how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were already talking about making it sound better. I don't know if you know who Rusty Humphreys is. He was there in an executive capacity.
Rusty Humphreys?
Rusty Humphreys.
I used to listen to him. Like, when I grew up, I always wanted to be in music radio.
Yeah.
And that evolved over time. And I, you know, Rush Limbaugh was always in my life. My dad listened to him and everything else. But I remember I was probably 18 or 19 years old, and I was working in some grimy warehouse, getting off at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I would go home, Rusty Humphreys would be on the radio. I would go to sleep every night listening to Rusty Humphreys.
There you
I don't even remember if I liked the show, but I knew I was listening to it.
He's good.
And it was planting a seed for me that later on turned into what I'm doing now.
So there we go. So we have that in common.
That's crazy.
And so Rusty was in he was an executive vice president. Basically, he ran USA Radio Networks. And he said, it sounds like it's done on Casio keyboard. We got to redo it. And they did. And there was a 2 minute, a 3 minute, and a 5 minute. And so I said, what if once this is reproduced and it sounds better, I take the 2 minute and I offer it to music stations? And I had a really supportive team there. And they're like, you're stupid. That's never going to work. And I was like, well, thank you guys. I really appreciate that vote of confidence. And I said, look, I'm confident. I feel like I can do it. Humor me. Let me try. Okay, go for it. And it turns out I was right. And so I called all these country music stations in the Bible Belt and said, hey, how do you like your news? And there'd be a long pause, and they'd be like, well, we hate it.
Mm.
And being the sales guy, I'm like, oh no, that's terrible. Tell me about your pain. So, what do you hate about it? Well, you know, we like being the CBS affiliate and everything, but you know, at the end of the day, I get 15 angry rednecks calling me every single day telling me I got liberal trash pumping out of my airwaves. And I'm like, oh, that's terrible. Here, I'm going to send you this demo. You take a listen, and then I'll give you a call next week. Invariably, they would end up calling me. when can we sign up and da-da-da-da, and he got on hundreds of music stations. And
wow.
So, and as you know, the thing about FM stations versus AM stations is FM, specifically music stations, have these things called human beings listening.
Right.
Which is important when you're selling ads. And so that was my launch into the media world.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, and I was thinking, like, when you're talking about doing news on a music station, like, that's, you know, when you're talking about, like, the difference between liberal and conservative news, it's kind of a big deal. Because, especially back then, there's a lot of people listening to music radio. And a lot of those people may just say, okay, this is the news. They're telling me the truth or whatever. And take it at face value. Except for those 15 rednecks who were angry about the liberal news coming over.
Correct.
That's wild, man. That's wild. You've got a pretty fascinating story that I've heard bits and pieces of.
Sure.
And this goes back to where are you originally from?
Colorado.
And you were, how long did you live out there?
It is it's jumbly. So, I mean, I moved a bunch as a child, but then I would always end up back in Colorado.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what the cumulative amount of years was, but, like, moved when I was 2, moved again when I was 6, and then ended up living in Germany, then moving back, and then so, but it was a long time. I mean, that was home for me. That, you know, that, and then my dad moved to Wichita, Kansas, in a little suburb of Wichita, Kansas called Derby.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was Colorado Springs and it was Derby, Kansas. Those were kind of the two main places that I grew up.
What had you hopping around all those places, especially Germany?
My mom has an itch to move. She used to. She doesn't anymore, thank God. But she used to, like, she would get bored and she would just want to move. And
really?
Then, you know, and again, this kind of gets back into my story. My mom was not a stable person. You know, she had issues. And so, you know, she would meet a new guy and we would move. And she'd meet another guy. And I had multiple stepdads and stuff like that. But then she had the great idea of joining the military. And so my mom joined the military. And that's how we ended up in Mannheim, Germany.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's, how old was she when she joined the military?
It was like 29, 30.
Okay. Yep. Wow. That's pretty, at that age, that's a pretty big decision to say, I guess if you don't like the way things are going, there's nothing wrong with joining the military and just trying to get things straightened out.
Sure.
So, you end up back here in, we'll say, Colorado. What'd you do when you got out of high school?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I'll just kind of go back a little bit. And so, talk a little bit about troubled childhood. My parents got divorced when I was 2. Parents put me with my mom. And, you know, there was a bit of a train wreck. I had no business being with my mom. My dad was obviously the much more stable person. And so, you know, 2 to 10 was, you know, watching my mom get beat. She was an alcoholic, had multiple stepdads, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
when I was 10, left Germany, moved in with my dad, who's in Wichita, Kansas. And there, began to have stability in my life. So he, you know, went to work every day at, you know, 4:30 in the morning, put a roof over our head, put food on the table. We ate dinner as a family, showed up to my baseball games, kind of had that stability. But from, you know, 2 to 10, I had a bunch of not stability. And so I was still kind of screwed up and had anger issues. And as I got older, really the only time that I was ever comfortable in my own skin is when I used to do drugs or drink, specifically in order, drink and then do drugs.
Right.
And so I began to do that a lot. And I found out pretty quickly that if you're going to do drugs and, you know, you're working at a grocery store, you got to sell drugs if you're going to afford them.
Right.
And had a knack for that. I was very much, I forget what that movie is, where the guy was the party liaison. Can't think of it. It was Ryan Reynolds.
What dog is that movie? I can't remember.
Anyway, but it was very much how that was me. And I get busted my senior year, the beginning of my senior year, sneaking out to go party and do drugs. My dad, you know, gives me a piss test and I failed for everything.
Yeah.
We got in a big fight and I ended up leaving and moving back to Colorado my senior year, and got there and my brother was driving for a drug dealer. And you know, I would ride around with him and he would have, you know, bricks of drugs, stacks of cash, girls all over him, you know, all the guys. Yeah. And I'm like, dude,
that's crazy.
Sign me up.
Right.
And so I did. And I
started, you're what, 18 at this point?
It was about 18 or 19. Yeah. Yep. Mm. It was 18. And so started doing that and, you know, developed that skill set really quick. And I always say the same thing that makes me good at what I do for a living now, which is network, persuasion, sales, made me really good at what I did for a living then.
Right.
And I did. And so I started out selling, you know, weed, and then next thing you know, it was cocaine. Next thing you know, it was meth. And then next thing you know, I'm pushing large amounts of drugs for cartels in Colorado Springs.
Wow. So that's crazy. So you're working for the big guys at that point.
Correct. Yeah.
And you got to be pushing a lot of product, I assume.
It wasn't massive amounts, and I wasn't ever, like, filthy rich. Like, I was a lifestyle guy. Like, I was hooked on the lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I was reliable. I was trustworthy. I was punctual. Like, all the same things that make you good at, like, real jobs.
Yeah. You don't really get that a lot of that out of drug dealers.
Yeah, you
honestly
don't. You do not. And so I shined. And so and I look like someone who could blend in with, you know, like, maybe a white neighborhood you were trying to get
like
into.
Like, non-drug dealers.
Yes, correct. Yeah. And so... but the biggest thing, it was trust, you know, and those guys trusted me, and because they trusted me, I had access to them, and some wild stories for sure. But it was, I mean, it's bad. You know, you look back on it now, it's like, I don't know how I survived, but
yeah, I think so. I think we can all look back at certain points in our life. Maybe it's not that dramatic,
sure,
but we have moments where we're like, man, we shouldn't have made it out of that.
Yeah.
That's pretty wild. So how far did that take you?
So it was about a five-year deal. And in that 5 years, I racked up 6 felonies. And what that looks like is I would get arrested. I would bond out. I would get arrested again. And then I would get sentenced to probation. And then on my probation, I would catch another case. And I would get arrested. And I would bond out. And then I would catch another case. And then they would give me probation. And that happened. You know, and it's just stacking up charges.
Do you find yourself in a situation where you get arrested and then, you know, not only are you're catching these charges and facing, you know, punishment, but you've got fines and everything else, and you got to turn around and maybe sell more drugs to pay those fines?
No, I didn't give a crap.
You weren't worried, like, about the fines?
Wasn't worried about going to probation meetings. Wasn't worried about none of that, dude. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, I always justify that. I'm like, well, I'm going to have to sell drugs to support myself. It's like, bro, you get a job.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
yeah.
But I didn't want to hear that. So yeah. And again, like I was addicted to drugs and alcohol. It reminds me of, drugs and alcohol have ruined my life. I was hooked on substances, but to me it was more the lifestyle, bro. Like I would get up every single day. Especially once so kind of the progression went from weed to cocaine and doing cocaine, and I was pushing lots of cocaine, doing lots of cocaine, just more than you could ever do,
right?
And just rails. And I would do so much cocaine to where I couldn't breathe out of my nose. And the next morning, it was the next afternoon, because it would be like 3 or 4 in the morning, I'd take Xanax, go to sleep, wake up, blow my nose, and like just blood, snot,
right,
cocaine would come out. And as soon as my nose stopped bleeding, I'd do it again. Well, it got so bad, like I've got a messed up deviated septum. I couldn't even snort drugs anymore. I'd done so much and whatever. And so that my friends like, here, smoke some crack. And I was like, I tried it. I'm like, that's not my bag. It's not for me. And then he's like, here, try some meth. Like, what a great friend, by the way. Right? Like, where do you get friends like this?
We'll find you something,
buddy.
We're
going to get you.
But
that is exactly how it went, though. And he got me hooked on meth. And, buddy, after that, it was on and cracking. And, I mean, I never slept. And I was always out, you know, coming up with some great plan of how we were going to put some system together to do.
And you went from Mr. Reliable to Mr. Super Reliable, because were on the go 24/7.
Yeah, I had a 24/7 business card basically at
that
point.
That's crazy.
So yeah, it was crazy. But
so you rack up 6 felonies. These all drug related.
Drug assault, stolen property, but it's all drug related. Yes.
Yeah, and it all comes to a head when.
So yeah, and so, I mean, there's so many, you know, weeds we could go down, like getting into the weeds about it all, but I think just kind of a cursory overview. Trying to think what the year was. It must have been 2005. All my cartel connections either went back to Mexico, as they would come over in like seasonal like shifts.
Mm-hmm.
So my guys either went back to Mexico or they got arrested. And they were arrested, and then I ended up bonding out or whatever, and so now I don't have my big plugs anymore, and so I get involved in, again, the creative meth economy, where I did know, like, we called them paisas, which means paisano, which is fellow countrymen, was what you called Mexican nationals. So you got Chicanos and you got paisas.
Yeah.
Paisas are the dudes from over the border.
Okay.
And you would meet them, and I didn't have the connection like I did with the other guys, but, you know, they were like, can you get, you know, stolen motorcycles? And I'm like, yeah, I can get you stolen motorcycles. And so we would fill up these storage units with stolen motorcycles, you know, ATVs, like, you know, this is like back before the player side-by-side days. I'm sure we had those, but it was like all, you know, Yamaha Banshees or, you know, just four-wheelers, crotch rockets. And what they would do is they would fill up trailers with them and then drive them back to Mexico where they weren't checking. And then they would have these brand-new crotch rockets over in Mexico or whatever, these brand-new four-wheelers that weren't stolen once they were across the border.
Man, I've played a lot of GTA in my day, but I've never lived it like this. Like, this is wild.
And so they would give me an ounce of meth for every motorcycle or four-wheeler, and then I would turn around and sell that. And that was my business model. Well, we had, I mean, I'm talking the storage units full, okay? And one of the guys gets busted. This was another reason that I had a lot of trust, is that I never told on anybody the entire time, my entire everything. I never ratted anybody out, never told on anybody, took everything, you know, to the joint, that, and that was it. And I really believed in that. Like, whatever I really believe in, I believe in. That's why I am the way I am about conservatism and everything else. I believe this, and I believed in that. Well, these other guys, like, in my mind, they're all that way, too. They were not.
No.
They get arrested. They jump in the back of a cop car, and they're rolling around and be like, Dawson keeps motorcycles there. Dawson's hiding motorcycles there.
Oh, they're
all busting these things open full of motorcycles and everything else. And they finally go to this guy's house. And this one was the dumb one. I never should have had anything in this guy's house. He never should have got interrogated by the cops. Like, he was never the guy that I was anticipating, whether I went to prison or not, was whether this guy kept his mouth shut or not, right? And so... but the cops raided his house and he sang like a bird, which, again, you know, it was my fault for ever having something there, but he still broke the rules. And, he told the cops, you know, not only, you know, is this motorcycle, you know, Dawson's, but, you know, he also carries a .38 special on his waist. And I was like, bro, are you like trying to get me killed? Like, what are you doing? And so anyway, he airs all that out, whatever. Well, I catch wind that I've got a warrant out for my arrest. I've not been to a probation meeting in 6 months, and I'm just like, I don't know if I have a warrant or not. I don't even know how to check for that. So, like, I call my probation officer, and I'm like, hey.
And you hadn't talked to him in 6 months.
I haven't talked to him in 6 months. And he goes, why don't you come? And this is, like, how gullible I was when it came to dealing with that kind of stuff. Very stupid in hindsight. And I'm like, hey, you know, I've heard I've got a warrant. And he goes, yeah, I'm not seeing anything. Man, why don't you come in and we can talk about it?
Oh,
right?
No.
And I'm like, yeah, no, I think I should. I want to start doing better, you know? And so I go to see the probation officer, and there's the cops are in the, like, so the door, anyway, oh, I guess we're on camera, you can see it. The door is here that I walk in here, and there's two cops here, and I walk in and shut the door, and boom, they freaking cuff me.
Did you ever even see the probation officer?
Yeah, he was there, and I was like,
yeah, thanks,
you know,
buddy.
Thanks
I thought you were
bunch.
My friend.
Yeah, I thought you were here to help me. And yeah, and so that was wild. And even then, I had keys in my pocket, and he's like, "Oh, how did you get here?" I'm like, oh, "I borrowed my aunt's car, and it was a stolen car." And then they're out in the park, like going around the courthouse with the key fob, and then they find the stolen car, and inside the stolen car, there's like a ring like this with all these key fobs from all these other stolen cars.
So do you cap all the keys from all the stolen vehicles on one key ring?
Well, we had all the vehicles, yeah, and so we had all the vehicles like spaced out throughout the city. And again, it was just, there was always a plan.
It's like a car lot, man.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It was nuts, man. But, and you know what's weird is I've never talked about any of this ever.
Like, really?
At this depth or at this level.
Man.
So I guess this is always what I anticipated going on Joe Rogan, some of the stories I would tell.
Yeah, this is it. That's wild. Because again, this is, I heard portions of your story on one of the 1819 podcasts you guys do. And, you know, when you think, all right, this conservative news station CEO, you don't expect those stories to come out of that person. So it caught my eye when I think I might have seen a clip on social media. I'm like, I got to find this podcast. And so I flip it up and I start hearing you talk about all this stuff. I'm like, dude, that's like a movie.
Yeah.
You're going to have to make a movie one day.
Well, I'm working on an autobiography, and I think that's the first step, and we'll see. And that's the reason that I'm, because I've been working on the autobiography, I've like really been like diving into, you know, where I, because I used to just kind of tell a, you know, cursory story, like 30,000 foot, this is what happened.
Yeah.
And again, and I don't want to go and like glorify this behavior like it was good. It was freaking terrible.
Right.
It was horrible. It was miserable. Like, I never knew where I was going to sleep, never knew where I was going to get my next meal. Like, yeah. And I would, you know, sell some drugs and I'd have some money and then Next thing you know, I'm sleeping in a stolen car because I can't get a hotel room, and it was, you know, feast or famine. It was just it was terrible, you know, and
exhausting. Exhausting, probably the word. Yeah.
And you know, I should be dead a thousand times over.
Yeah,
had some really bad people that wanted to kill me. You know,
I bet that's what I was thinking as you were explaining that. I'm like, as soon as you mentioned cartels in this story, like they you make it out alive. That's good. That's a win.
And they were never the ones that were after me, thankfully.
Crazy. So when you get hemmed up by the cops at the probation office, what happens then?
Well, they just arrested me, and then I ended up bonding out again. But so what comes to an end though is that gentleman who told the cops, you know, that they put the warrant out, I get arrested, I end up bonding out again.
When you bond out, you're like, hey, can I at least have one of those keys off the key ring?
Yeah, because
I gotta
get a ride. But I was in there for another 4 months, and this is where I learned this legal thing called discovery. Okay, and so in the legal world, discovery is all the evidence that the state has against you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm reading my discovery because I got nothing else to do, and I'm reading it, and in this discovery, it tells you all the people that told on you, because that's part of the evidence that the state has against you.
Right.
And so I'm like, he told on me, and he told on me, and he told, this is crazy.
Yeah.
And so I got out, and I went and found all these people.
Oh, right? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And got into altercations with all of them, and then finally, the last guy, the one that told on me. And again, I felt terrible, and the guy that was with me was like pumping me up. He's like, you can't let him off. He told on you. We got to go in there. He owes us money, blah, 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 blah. And so we went, and I knocked on the door. He opens the door. I kind of push myself in and say, look, man, why'd you tell me? I didn't tell on you. I didn't tell on you. I said, yes, you did. I know you did. You know, I didn't tell on you. I promise. You know, all my, you know, blah, 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 all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And so I just started beating him up really bad. And I was tasing him and beating him. And then the guy that was with me had a blackjack. And I don't know if you know what that is, but it's like a leather, like small baton that's got like a mechanical spring that's like real heavy duty. And then on the tip of it, it's like lead weight, but it's all wrapped in leather. And so the way that it works is it like catches skin. And the guy I was with hit him in the forehead with a blackjack, and his head split open and blood went everywhere.
Oh, man.
And it was awful. I thought he was going to die. We ended up stealing some stuff that we thought was worth money in the house and told his brother, hey, you know, if you don't, you know, give us the money you owe us, this is going to be you next. And we left. I got arrested that night.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's where they charged me with attempted murder, aggravated robbery, and extortion.
Wow.
And
okay.
They ended up dropping the attempted murder, you know, and it was ended up being first degree assault, aggravated robbery, and extortion, but the original charge was attempted murder. And so, so that happens. And I'm in county for 2 weeks, and I bond out again. Now I'm on like $135,000 worth of bonds, and
I was going to say, is the judge not like, hey, this guy's a menace? Yeah. We got to keep him in here.
The next one was
okay. Keep going.
I find my limits. Like I push things to the limit, and so, and so I'm bonded out now. And at this point, I make two decisions. One, I'm done doing like uber stupid stuff as far as like going out and I don't know, beating people up.
Right.
I'm done stealing things. I'm done hurting people. Like I've got a belly full of at this point. I'm like, I'm good. I start hanging out with my brother, and my brother is 2 years older than me. And like all the guys that I used to go to school with and stuff, and they all like drink beer and barbecue and like are getting married and like starting to have kids. And I'm just like, I'm a freaking loser, dude. Like I suck. But I'm not going to court, I can tell you that. Right? Skipping bail because I'm going to go do the rest of my life in prison. So I become a fugitive. And I become a fugitive, and I get away from the cops on a number of occasions, and the you know bounty hunters or whatever that are coming after
me. Are you in Colorado at this
point?
This
is Colorado Springs, okay. Yeah. And so I get away from the cops a couple different times. That happens. They're putting up perimeters now. Every neighborhood where I'm known to be, they're putting up perimeters and like showing my picture.
Oh, you are most wanted.
I was one of the most wanted fugitives in Colorado Springs.
Wow.
Correct. And so Dog the Bounty Hunter, if you know where he does his work, Colorado Springs, Durango, Colorado, and then Hawaii. Those are the three places that Dog the Bounty Hunter operates, right? And so I have no idea. I'm just gonna say I don't know how true this is, but this is what I was told by an arresting officer the day that I get arrested. Is that Dog the Bounty Hunter was, so they were doing a 72-hour, 72 fugitive sweep that I was a part of. And so they had the Fugitive Task Force, Colorado Springs Police Department, and then, you know, Dog the Bounty Hunter and these other different bounty hunters. And they were going to do this big 3-day sweep and get as many fugitives as they can. And I was on that list. But I was considered, you know, too dangerous for Dog the Bounty Hunter to come after, right? And which is like, put that on your business card. And they're like, he's armed and dangerous. And I'm like, I was armed with like a meth pipe and a backpack, right? Like, I was totally not
they're
armed
like,
and dangerous.
Even if we catch this guy, we're not going to be able to put him on the show. He's that dangerous.
But the thing is that because Dog the Bounty Hunter, he has a felony, and so he can't have a gun. And so he uses paintball guns. I don't know if you remember this. He used paintball guns, and he had pepper spray paintballs.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that's how he would, like, you know, if people ran over, he'd like, pop, 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 and he'd get them with pepper spray paintballs. And
that's funny.
And then he'd arrest them. And so because of that, he had to basically, like, if someone was, for real legit, like, armed and dangerous, and they pulled out a gun, and he'd be, like, have his paintball gun, you know?
Oh, my God.
I don't know if it was, like, an insurance thing or what, but, you know, the cop explained to me, he goes, yeah, you're, you know, considered too dangerous for the Dog the Bounty Hunter, and so.
Lucky for you, you didn't get hit with pepper balls out of a paintball gun.
Oh, I it was bad, though, so I'll tell you. So June 19th, 2007, this is my last day out. So I've skipped bond, become one of the most wanted fugitives. They're putting up checkpoints. I've gotten away from the cops on a number of occasions. Now, June 19th, 2007, I'm in a third-story apartment. This is my safe house where, you know, I'm going to be. And I'm in this third-story apartment here. There's another apartment building here. I wake up in the afternoon. I'm cooking bratwurst, watching the Chappelle Show, smoking weed.
Oh, I love Chappelle Show.
Yeah. It's just a weird thing that I remember. But I look out the window, and I see the front end of a cop car. They pulled out just too far to where I could see it was the front end of a cop car with the little flashlight side mirror thing. And I'm like, oh. I know what time it is.
Yeah.
And I had, in my infinite wisdom and success in getting away, I got kind of cocky in my ability to get away. And so my friend had given me some nylon rope, and I tied it to the bottom of this recliner, this orange retro recliner that was wider than the window in the apartment.
Yeah.
And so I go to grab that, and I hear boom, and the doors, like, they don't know which apartment I'm in, so they're kicking in every single door on this floor.
Jeez.
Boom, Colorado Springs police, open up. Boom, Colorado. And so I'm like, I got to go. I kick out the screen, wrap the rope around my hand, and I jump, and I'm hanging three stories up. And what I didn't know is there was a surveillance van in the back, and then, you know, they called it in, hey, your dude's freaking hanging. and 50 or 60 cops come swarming around the sides with their guns drawn, get the F on the ground.
Wow.
I'm like, I don't have anywhere else to go. I kind of plan on going to the ground.
So
I drop, I hit the ground, he puts his knee in my back, cuffs me, you know, and they put me in the back of the cop car, and that was a wrap.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild. Yeah, that one last ditch effort. You're like, tied around the recliner, baby. Let's go. It's go time.
Let's roll.
What is your, you got a roommate at that time or a friend that was in that the safe house with you?
No, it was this kid, Mike. I don't even know Mike's last name. He was this weird kid, and like, you know, he basically had to do what he was told.
Oh, okay.
And he was told, Brian's going to stay at your apartment. You are not going to say anything. And he's like, okay.
And so this was probably a normal day for him, I guess, if he's
normally
doing
these.
Until
he came home and saw all the doors kicked in and his window out. And all
wonder what it was like for the rest of the residents there at that apartment.
I'm sure they didn't appreciate having
one
the doors
after another kicking the door open.
Yeah.
God, that's wild. So, all right. So they take you, and I'm not trying to make you drag this out.
I
this
don't
is fascinating.
Care. Yeah,
this is so fascinating. So they get you on that deal. They take you to jail. You go in front of the judge.
Yeah. So it was an ordeal, and so I'm now facing 384 years in prison if I go to trial, and how that breaks down. I don't know that I believe that, but like I always say that because again, this is what I was told by my public defender. Said, okay, Mr. Dawson, you have the attempted murder, the aggravated robbery, and the extortion. They dropped the attempted murder to, I think it was an F3, an aggravated F3, first degree assault. The aggravated robbery was an F3, and then the extortion was an F3. And it's 32 years because they're aggravated for each of those, and they're going to stack them, and that's 96. This is your sixth felony. And so anything three, it's called the habitual criminal. They call it. And then anything four or more is called the big habitual criminal. And so they called it the little bitch, which is habitual.
Right.
The little bitch and the big bitch. And the big and the big bitch is the four times four.
And you were the big bitch.
I was the big bitch.
Okay.
Right? And so and there's always a reference. I go back to Cartman saying she's a big one. Anyway, if I went to trial, they could give me the 96, and they could times it by four, and then that's where they get the 384 years if I wanted to take it to trial. And so I'm sitting in county jail thinking I'm fixing to do the rest of my life in prison, And so I'm clicking up with some of my guys, right, that got locked up, that were in there, the bad guys, if you will, the cartel guys that are in there. And I'm hanging out with them, and I'm low man on the totem pole, and so I got to go carry out, you know, they call them the torpedoes, like, hey, that dude's a snitch, you got to go in there and handle it. And so I got to go beat this dude up.
Mm.
Hey, this, and so I end up catching two more assault cases in county jail.
Yeah.
And so I get two more misdemeanor assault cases, and they put me in ADSEG, which is called administrative segregation,
mm-hmm.
which is, you're in a cell by yourself, solitary confinement, 23 hours a day. You get an hour out to make a phone call, and to take a shower, and then you go back to your cell.
Yeah.
And so I was in there for about 4 months, and about 3 months in, I kind of have this epiphany moment, okay? And it's a real silly epiphany, but it was a very substantial epiphany in my life that I realized it was my fault. I said, God thumped me on the head and said, this is your fault, Brian. Because up to that point, it was my mom's fault, it was my dad's fault, it was the cop's fault, it was the judge's fault, it was the system's fault. I really believed it. Like, yeah. I legitimately was, like, angry, and I was telling my family I'm a victim, and I'm part of this messed up system. And when I came to the conclusion that I'd created this, my choices created these bad circumstances, what I realized is that I was free to make good choices that would create good circumstances. It was just like this liberating aha moment in my life. And so, as much as I could, in a limited form in a cell by yourself, began to start making better decisions. And what ended up happening is like just an overall attitude change in me. My family began to notice that attitude change, and they began to like really support me and stuff. Cause at that point, they'd cut me off completely. I'd get to call them like once on the weekend. They would answer and talk to me for 20 minutes, and that was it.
Yeah.
And they began to notice the changes and stuff, and really started to, you know, get back in my life and believe that they sensed, they knew me, right? They knew, and then they're like, something's changed. And so they started to kind of get back behind me again. Well, my attorney general, the district attorney, and then you have the public defender.
Yeah.
My public defender, which is not when you're facing 384 years.
It's not what you want. No.
Comes back to me and says, okay, Mr. Dawson, they're willing to offer you if you go to trial, you can get 384 years if you lose, and you're going to lose. And I'm like, I know, I'm aware. And they said, but they're going to offer you a 32 year sentence with a crime of violence sentence enhancer, which means I'm going to do every bit of 20 years.
Yeah.
If I take that. And so by the grace of God, I was able to get into a mediation hearing. I actually got it would take forever to explain it all, but I ended up getting a real attorney, not like a high paid, you know, super attorney or anything like that. But my family was able to talk to this guy who came highly recommended, and was able to get him, you know, at like a fraction of the cost that all these other attorneys wanted. And he was able to get me into a mediation hearing. And
what do you mean by that?
Mediation hearing. Yeah, sure. So what happens is in a mediation hearing, you're basically like your family can write all these letters of recommendation that gets sent to the district attorney. And there's a retired judge. His name was Judge Toth. And I would be in one room with my attorney. The district attorney would be in another room. And the mediator, Judge Toth, a retired judge, would go back and forth. And you like, it was like arbitration, you know, it was like horse trading. And so the district attorney said, we're going to offer Mr. Dawson 32 years with this crime of violence. And then I'd say, well, I think I should only get 8 years because this guy did a way more heinous crime and he only got 8 years, da 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 da.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back and forth. Well, it worked out to my advantage because we had tried to get it on the calendar for like a month and we could never get our days to line up that my attorney was available. I was available.
Right? I didn't have a lot going on.
But my attorney and her could not get on the same page. And so it ends up being like Martin Luther King Day or something that she has off, and she shows up to the jail. We were supposed to do it at the courthouse, but since we never could and my stuff was coming up, she shows up in pajamas. The district attorney shows up in pajamas to the freaking county jail, okay? And I'm like, you know, she does not want to be there.
Right.
And so I use this to my advantage, and I'm like, well, I got 300 and some years. I got nowhere to go. And so I'm just dragging it out as long as I possibly can. And so she finally, you know, we think 32 years. Well, I think 8. Well, we think 24. Well, I think 10, you know, and just da-da-da-da-da back and forth. And then finally she comes back and says, I will give 15 years. I'm not going any lower, and I'm not dropping this crime of violence. You've caught two more assault cases since you've been in county jail, plus the heinousness of your crime. I'm not going to do that. And I looked at my attorney and I said, look, Judge Toth aside, you know, the mediator side, you go walk into that room with that woman and tell her, I don't want to end up. And so Lyman is like a maximum security prison in Colorado. And everyone knew, like, that's where you go if you're
the worst of the worst.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. I said, I don't want to end up in Lyman with swastikas all over my face, okay?
Right.
I want to change my life, and I need an opportunity to do that. Tell her that I will give her a year if she drops that crime of violence. And that crime of violence sentence enhancer, what it does is it means you're going to use you're going to do a lot larger portion of your time, and you're not going to be eligible for a lot of the vocational and, you know, educational programs and stuff that they offered in the Colorado Department of Corrections. So I knew I had to get rid of that crime of violence sentence enhancer, and so I said, I'll give you a year. And she's like, oh, you'll give me a year? Where do I sign? I'm like, well, I guess all those convictions about me not getting that crime of violence went away real quick.
Giving her a year, what does that mean?
So instead of 15 with the crime of violence, I got 16 with no crime of violence.
Oh, yeah, that's a no-brainer for you.
Yeah, for me. And for her, 16 looks better on her thing than...
Yeah, because they're just looking
correct. For... Correct. Numbers. Exactly. Yeah. Averages. And so it was a win-win. And so my negotiating prowess came in once again.
Look at that.
Yeah.
God, man. Never fails you.
Yeah. And so I get shipped off to the Colorado Department of Corrections shortly after that. I left from an ADSEG cell. There's so many funny stories I could go into. I'm going to just keep it moving. Keep it moving.
No, you're good. You're good. Whatever.
Yeah. So I end up... getting shipped off to prison, you know, you roll in and, I always, if I've got time, I tell this portion of the story because like, you go from being in county jail, which is not a fun place, not a good place. But then you're shackled, which is your foot cuffed and your feet cuffed are chained to your belt and your handcuffs are chained to your belt and you're walking like this.
Yeah. It's like in the movies.
They put you on a bus. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly what this felt like. And so I'm shackled to some dude who's next to me, and we're on this white bus that goes up to Denver Reception and Diagnostic Center. They call it DRDC. You go in there, and there's, like, this sliding barbed wire fence that opens, and then the truck pulls in, and it's, like, this little, like, interim area, and then they shut it, and then they're looking underneath the van for bombs and stuff like that, and there's just, like, roll upon roll of razor wire all over the place, and there's the gun tower with the armed guards that are there to shoot you if you do something wrong.
Yeah.
And it was a very...
Surreal
yeah. moment when that happened. Is you're not in Kansas anymore, you're not in county anymore. And so I end up there that they go in there and make sure that you're not part of a gang or, you know, you don't have any health issues or whatever, and they assign you to a prison, and they sent me to Walsenburg, which is Huerfano County Huerfano County Correctional Center in Walsenburg, Colorado. Got there and got to my unit, and the first guy I meet was a guy by the name of Charles Frederick. And he came up and introduced himself. He's a real big dude, bigger than me, and he's got a Semper Fi tattoo on his arm. You could tell he'd been down for a number of years and knew his way around the joint. And he says, my name's Charles, this is a faith pod, and I'm a Christian. Well, that's a really weird way to introduce yourself.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah, especially in prison. And I said, okay, Charles, what is a faith pod? And he goes, well, man, you know, we do discipleship in here. You know, I take seminary classes on the weekends, and we do praise and worship every morning. I said, I got to get out of here. Get me out of here. But, you know, I just became friends with Charles, and he began to kind of plant gospel seeds in my life as conversation allowed.
Yeah.
And he ended up getting shipped to Sterling. That prison closed. I ended up in Bent County Correctional Center. I was there for 6 months, left Bent County, went to Arrowhead in Canyon City, Colorado. I was there for a couple months. And they realized that they put me, my sentence and crime was too severe for that low of a things. It was like a vacation, though. I got to go to like Camp Cupcake for a couple months, you know.
Really?
It's like up in the mountains, and I'm like, freaking hey, I could just stay here forever.
And then when you found out that they were pulling you out of there, you were like, come on.
But they ended up shipping me to Sterling, and Sterling Correctional Facility's got like this horrible reputation or whatever. But again, you got to understand, my mindset in there was like, any vocational program you got, I'm taking. Any educational opportunity you got, I'm taking. Any self-help program you got, like, I'm that is what I am on. I am on changing my life. And because when I got sentenced to 16 years instead of 32 or instead of 15 with the crime of violence, I made a decision that I was going to look at prison as an opportunity to change my life and not look at it as punishment. And I stuck with that. I maintained that. And I'm going there, and I don't know anything about Sterling's programs or what they have to offer. I just hear all this bad talk. Like, inmates don't like it there. When most inmates are there, they just want to do tattoos and drugs and just whatever, right? They're not trying to change their life. And so when I get to Sterling, and the programs building there is bigger than the whole facility I just left. I mean, it's massive. They've got all kinds of vocational training and programs and everything else. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is great. And so, boom, I get there. Well, first person I walk out on the yard, there's Charles.
Oh, wow.
Right? Boom, yeah. There he is again. And same thing. We become friends. He's coaching a softball team, and I'm on a softball team. And he used that to kind of evangelize inmates by coaching the softball team. And so, you know, there it was again. And, you know, I ended up taking, you know, college classes there. I took computer information systems. I took graphic design. I took printing technologies, all kinds of stuff that, to some degree, I use now in media, stuff I learned. And it was good. And I did a bunch of other stuff in there. But, you know, a couple years into it, Charles is like, hey, man, you need some certificates for the parole board. You got parole coming up in a couple years. I can get you into these programs. I'm like, sure, go ahead. Well, they would end up being these, like, Christian faith-based programs. Mm-hmm. And I was like, freaking Charles, dude.
You know, he duped me, swindizzled me.
Yeah. And the first one was kind of, you know, kumbaya, come as you are, whatever. And I really enjoyed it. And so I asked Charles to get me another one that was ended up not being kumbaya, come as you are. It was very much, this is what the Word of God says.
Right.
And so I get into it, and I'm not liking it. And so I'm arguing with it. You do an hour video. It's called The Truth Project. You do an hour video, and then there would be an hour of table conversation. I would just argue with these guys at the table and tell them how stupid they were for what they believed.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, and just because they were Christians didn't mean they weren't convicts, right? And so, correct. Like, you go tell some convict that believes in Jesus that he's a, you know, he's a retard for believing something, he might want to throw down, right?
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
it got heated, and we were walking back to the unit, and Charles is like, done. He's like, dude, like, I've been working on you for years, and you're fixing to get us into fist fight over
he's
this stuff.
Up.
Like, he's fed up.
Yeah.
And he just looks at me and says, Brian, why don't you give him a chance, right? And so up to that point, you know, I'd been told that a million times, a knee-jerk reaction. I've given Jesus a chance, whatever. And so, you know, I always believed in God. And through when I was on the run from the police, through my drug addiction, through everything, I always prayed to God. I knew God was real, but I didn't understand how Jesus factored into it.
Right.
And so, and it was my belief at the time, I was agnostic. I believed that a Jewish guy got nailed to a piece of wood 2,000 years ago and created a cult following.
Mm.
But I didn't understand who Jesus was in the Christian faith. I didn't understand it. And so, I went back to my cell that night and I prayed the way that I usually did. I said, God, if I need to believe this Jesus character was truly your son, that he was born of a virgin, because these were the problems that I had. He was born of a virgin, that he lived a perfect life, that he died and somehow his death benefits me, and that he rose from the dead. These are my issues with the Christian faith. If I need to believe those things to be okay with you, I need some kind of a sign.
Yeah.
And so I end up going to sleep that night. It was Saturday night. I end up having this crazy nightmare. It was horrible, and then I end up falling off a cliff in the dream. And if you've ever fallen in a dream and, like, you, like, shoot up, you know, like, ugh.
Yeah, you hit the ground
yeah.
as soon as you wake up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've just kind of, like, sweat in my face, and I look, and the only thing I can see in my cell is a clock that says 3:16. And if you're not a Bible, you know, guy, John 3:16 was the only Bible verse I'd ever known my entire life.
Right.
Which is, for God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son. Whoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life, which was the question that I answered, you know, I asked, and
yeah.
that was the answer. And I'm like, whoa. I kind of tried to, like, oh, no, that can't be real, whatever. Well, it was Sunday morning at 3:16. I'm like, okay, God, I'll go to church.
Yeah.
Okay? And so I get up that next morning at, like, 8, go to Christian services, what they call it. Sit as far to the back, to the side as I possibly can. And I don't remember anything that Chaplain Davis preached, but at the end, he did an invitation. And I looked over at my friend Ramon that I was with, and I said, hey, man, what is an invitation? And he wasn't like, brother, that's where you invite Jesus into your heart. He said, man, if you got something hindering your relationship with God, you can go down there and pray with that man about it.
Yeah.
I said, okay. And he stepped aside. He already knew I was going. So I walked the aisle, as it were, and Chaplain Davis grabbed my hand and put his hand on my shoulder and said, you know, Mr. Dawson, how can I pray for you? I said, look, chap, I'm not here to make any decisions. I just want you to pray that God would soften my heart so the truth can come in, because I can tell he's working on me. I'm fighting with everything I have.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay. So we get done praying, and I look up in his face, and he just weeping. And I'm like, what is going on, man? Like, Chaplain Davis is not like a crying dude, you know, and he's in front of 130 inmates and he's just weeping.
Like, get it together, yeah. chap. What's wrong with you?
But it had me, you know, choked up, and like, I knew something had happened. You
yeah.
know, like, it was just, I was very aware that something had changed. And it turns out Chaplain Davis and Charles had been praying for me for years, right? And I didn't know that. And but that's the day that I got saved and
yeah.
and became a believer. And Charles gave me a Bible. He said, start reading the story of Joseph. And so I just started reading the Bible every single day, feasting on God's word. And that went on for, I don't know, about 9 months. And I got, you know, I continued reading my Bible, and I was involved in all these faith-based programs and stuff. But I ended up like all my friends in there had pen pals. Now, like, they weren't like the greatest girls in the world, you know,
right?
You know?
Right.
But they had pen pals. I'm like, man, I'd like to have a pen pal. So I get on the phone with my mom, and she's running a Facebook page for me, you know. And I'm just like, reach out to some girls from my past, like, that weren't drug addicts, like a real low bar.
Yeah,
like, weren't drug addicts. And so I strike out, you know. I found out that girls don't like writing guys in prison. I was like, this is so weird. I was, you know, so optimistic going into this.
Yeah.
And just struck out completely. And I'm like, all right, I'm done. And I went back and prayed. I'm like, God, if you want me to have a pen pal, you're going to have to do this. I'm good on the rejection stuff. I'm just going to keep reading my Bible and doing my programs and stuff. And so I did. You know, 2-3 weeks goes by. I call my mom, and she's like, hey, Brian, do you know a girl named Christina Ewan? I was like, yeah. Christina Ewan was a girl I was head over heels in love with all throughout middle school and high school. Like, I went to 8th grade graduation dance with her and professed my undying love to her, and she gave me the Heisman, put me in the friend zone.
Yeah, you know, right,
never
right.
Happened to you growing up. I found myself in the friend zone often. And that went on from 8th grade to the beginning of my 12th grade year when I moved to Colorado, that I was in the friend zone with her. But I was like, man, Mom, if you laid out all my yearbooks from kindergarten to 12th grade and said you can pick one girl to marry, it'd be Christina all day, right, no hesitation. Right. But surely she's married to some doctor in a 3,500 square foot house with a white picket fence, 2.5 kids, you know, dog, minivan. Like, that's where Christina is. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, no, Christina's not, but she wants to write you. And I'm like, does she know I'm in prison? Yeah. And I'm like, that's wild. And I said, did you get her address? Yeah. And so I wrote her the first letter, and I was like, look, I didn't get drunk and run somebody's dog over. I belong here. She wrote me back and is like, hey, you know, I got married. You know, had a husband, and we had a son, and, you know, we got divorced. He left, and, you know, and she had just gotten saved as well, like 3 months after I did, and she was writing about that, and she's like, I'm in Alabama, right? And so I was like, okay. And so we wrote back and forth, and just began to talk about, you know, what the preacher was preaching on, you know, what we were wanting out of life, that kind of stuff, and really just fell in love through written correspondence. But I had to write her after she's rejected me my whole life. I had to write her a letter and be like, hey, Christina, I realize my stock can't get any lower.
Right? So think about that. You're going through school, and you got this girl you're in love with, and she's putting you in the friend zone year after year. You end up graduating high school, and you're like, okay, well, that didn't work out. I'm going to have to go with my second choice, wherever she is. And never did you think leaving high school was, I'm going to be sitting in prison writing her when she finally, like, accepts me and wants to talk to me.
No way. And I joke that her picker is so broken that I had to go to prison before I showed up on her radar. Right? That's my rolling joke with her. But... yeah, and so I wrote her, and she wrote me, you know, I said, look, I realize my stock can't get any lower, but I can't help but feel like there's a spark here that just didn't exist when we were, you know, growing up. And she wrote me back and said, I feel the exact same way. Whether you're out in 10 days or 10 years, I'm going to be here waiting for you. I know God wants me to be with you.
Wow.
Right? And she was. And so I ended up putting in for a halfway house shortly after that. And so the way it works in Colorado, on a 16-year sentence, at 8 years, you're eligible for parole. And then 19 months before that, on a nonviolent crime, which was key in my negotiations.
Yes, very important.
19 months prior to that, you're eligible for a halfway house. And then your earn time, that comes even closer. So at 5 years, 2 months, I was eligible to get out to a halfway house.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put in for this intense behavior modification program called Pier 1. Pier 1 is the most intense behavior modification program of its kind in the country. It actually just closed a couple months ago, but up to that point. And because I put in for this crazy program, they let me out. They're like, you want to go there? And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, yeah, go ahead. Go nuts.
Yeah.
And it's like the graduation rate there, I don't know, it was something like 20% of people that go there actually finish the program successfully, right?
It was like a boot camp or something?
Yeah, it was like mental boot camp. We could do a whole podcast just on Pier 1. It was freaking wild.
Man.
Wild. But the goal of it was to break you in a safe environment.
Yeah.
So the goal was to, you know, I mean, they cuss you out, tell you how stupid you were, how worthless you were, all this other stuff, and you're just, like, trying to, like, do what you're supposed to do, and, like, you can't, and eventually you lose it.
Yeah.
And then they circle up the chairs, and everybody sits down and be like, well, why'd you lose it, man? Like, because you were freaking telling me I was a piece of, you know, like, what do you mean? Why did I lose it? But then you actually start to realize, like, why do I care what he thinks? Why do I, you know?
Yeah.
But it was very, very good, man. I learned so much good stuff in that program. And I went through it. It was a 2-year, 1-year inpatient, 1-year outpatient. So 2-year program Ended up getting through it, and the first six months, I wasn't allowed to write Christina, but she could write me, and so she wrote me a letter a week for 26 weeks. It's amazing, faithful.
Wow.
Get to the point in the program where I'm able to go out on visits. We got married the very first visit in my grandma's living room.
That's awesome.
And, yeah, and so we basically eloped, got married, and then I ended up finishing the program and transferring all my parole and stuff down to Alabama, and that was December of 2014, I believe. And I finished my parole in April of 2015, if I'm remembering that correctly. And it was wild. So, like, I went from doing my parole meetings in Denver, Colorado, to doing parole meetings in Tuskegee, Alabama, because we lived in Shorter.
Yeah.
And when we, you know, when I moved down here, that was a culture shock.
That's crazy. Yeah. Man, listening to that story, that's wild, by the way. To go from all of that to where you are today. You were talking about Charles. What was Charles?
Yeah, so Charles Frederick, and Charles is the guy that led me to the Lord in prison. He went to Pier 1 as well. We ended up finding a church together where he's now an elder at that church. And I was the best man in his wedding. And he's got a halfway house ministry that he runs that's wildly successful.
So you're still Charles to Charles today?
Oh, yeah. And my son's named after him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I've got 7 children, by the way. I don't know if you knew that.
Really?
Yeah.
7?
7 children.
Man.
So
what's the oldest and the youngest?
So 14, my son, Christina, had a son when we got married. Mm-hmm. He was Brennan. Amazing young man. Unbelievably intelligent, respectful, hardworking, athletic. I mean, he's just like everything you could ever ask for in a son. He's amazing. And then he's 14, and then it goes 9, 8, 6, 5. He'll be 5 here in a couple weeks, Charles will. And then 3 and then 18 months.
Wow. Wow, those are some lucky kids to have a dad like you that's got the experience that you do. I'm thinking as you're telling me this story, I'm like, how crazy is it to you to go from all of that to where you are today? And I was bringing up Charles because that's definitely a God thing, going from all those experiences through prison, through the assaults, through the drug dealing, the grand theft auto, all the way to CEO of a conservative news outlet. Where else does that happen? I mean, that's crazy.
No, and that's the thing is people, you know, and no one really challenges me on the evidence of God. I don't communicate with people even in that fashion to where, like, I'm going to debate you on that premise. It's
right.
Like my absolute presupposition is the existence of God and the truth of his word. And if people want to, that's fine. I'm not even going to entertain a conversation otherwise. But you can't. Like, it doesn't. And so my dad is an atheist, right? And which mm-hmm. is wild. I think he's more agnostic, whatever. And like the fact that his son got his life together, got it, like went from going to do the rest of my life in prison, changing my life, becoming, you know, semi-successful, whatever you want to call it. He's just like, well, it's finally you finally started listening to all that stuff I told you. I'm like, oh, that's it, Dad.
Come on. That's proof,
yeah,
cuz.
That's it.
Come on.
Yeah, but what gets him is he looks at my wife, and he's like, because he knew Christina, right? We grew up together. And he's like, what? And she's the most amazing woman on the planet. Like,
yeah.
Unbelievable mom. She homeschools the kids. Like, I mean, it's just like she you know, the whole idea of turning a house into a home, you know what I mean? Like, I come home, like, I'll come home from work tonight. There'll be bread baking that she made, homemade, you know what I mean? And it'll smell up the house, it'll be clean, the kids, I mean, it's just, it's crazy how
like
amazing
the,
she is.
The Brady Bunch,
yeah,
at your house.
No, it's wild. And so she's just amazing, and you know, she's tough, all this stuff. So my dad sees that, and he's like, that's what gets him. He can't explain that.
Yeah,
he can't. And you know,
well, because of you and your situation, like, one day it's going to click for him.
Yeah.
And I know you've probably got faith that will happen as
yeah.
well. But the fact that, and it's going to click because of your story and your family, because, like you said, at some point you got to be like, how else? I mean, I'm sitting here listening to the story. I'm like, how else would that happen?
Yeah.
That's wild. That's just, that was much more of a roller coaster than I expected.
Sure.
Because, again, I just heard pieces of it.
Yeah.
But, like, that's pretty
yeah,
wild,
I
got to
tell you, I'm fascinated. I've just been listening. I'm like, whoa, you know.
Yeah, it's wild, man. And, you know, and then my career story, so I kind of gave you guys a piece. So I moved to Alabama a little over 9 years ago. And my friend's working for USA Radio Networks, and he lives in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, hey, man, you have a job when you get to Alabama. I'm like, well, not when I really want. He goes, great, you're going to be an affiliate relations manager at USA Radio Networks.
These are coming straight out of prison, yeah. All this stuff, and now you're working at kind of a big-time radio game.
Well, it was not big-time at all at USA Radio Networks, but there was some interim, and so when I got out of prison, first I couldn't work because I was in the program, and I had to go through the program, and then it got to the point where you could work. I did day labor, which is making like $7 an hour and just like schlepping tile or, you know, scraping insulation in 100-degree weather, or it was just awful. And so my friend is working in a tax resolution firm. He's like, hey, man, I think you'd do good at this. And it's basically phone sales, and you're calling people who have tax liens to make like $280 a day, calling people who have tax liens and offering these legal services to you know, I'm sure you guys probably have one of them advertises on the station.
Yeah,
I guarantee you. Right. And so it was my job to call these people or whatever. But it was great because they had the stuff called air conditioning.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was big fan.
I was able to get in some of that.
Yeah, and but, I mean, dude, like that was – that was intense. Like, you know, the I see why people quit and just give up and go back, because it was very hard. And it wasn't because the system's rigged against you and all this other nonsense. That's not it. It's just life is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And when you begin to face your consequences and start to make good decisions, it's just hard. And, I mean, I used to have to, because I couldn't get my driver's license back because I had a DUI and all this other stuff, and I had to go through these classes and pay these fines and work and get all this stuff. And so I'd ride my bike to the train station, and because it was 2 hours on either walking, riding my bike, and public transit to get to work. And so it was 2 hours to work and then 2 hours home. And I would be riding my bike, and it would be snowing in Colorado or whatever, and someone would, like, drive by, and, like, slush would come up from them driving by and just, like, cake me. You know, yeah. It's freezing cold, wet. I'm going into this law firm, kind of dressed how I am now, and I'm just got, like, mud and sleet all over me, and everyone's looking at me like, what is wrong with him?
Man.
Just sit down and pound the phones, get to work. And you just have to, you know, have a just a level of commitment that's you're not going to take no for an answer. So
that's wild. That is so wild. Yeah. So you end up going through. We talked about the USA Radio thing. Kind
sure.
Of what you
yeah.
Did
no,
there.
That's the other crazy. So I'm at USA Radio Networks. So I was doing the law firm, doing the tax resolution sales. That's what I was doing when I moved here.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, hey, do you have a job? No. Great. You're going to be at USA Radio Networks. You're going to be affiliate relations manager. I said, what is a radio network and what is an affiliate relations manager?
Yeah.
I have no idea. And he explains to me it's taking nationally syndicated content and offering it to terrestrial radio stations like Talk 99.5, saying, mm-hmm. hey, you should carry this news or you should carry this show. And Steve Dace was the first show that I ever represented. I don't know if you know Steve Dace.
Yeah.
He's my favorite. And he was there, and then Rusty Humphreys came in later and helped him with his show. It was called Trending Today USA. But I grew their news product, as I described earlier on in the podcast, and a gentleman by the name of Lee Habib discovered me. Lee Habib created Laura Ingraham's radio show back in 2001.
Okay.
And he and Laura went to UVA law school together, and he had the bright idea years down the road of saying, hey, you know what, Laura, you need to be on the radio. And I think she's like, yeah, let's do it. And he's like, man, you're just as smart. You're just as intellectual. You're just as articulate. You're all these things, and you look a lot better than these old gray-haired guys, right? And said, okay, let's do it. I think they created a segment on Don Imus, and then once they did enough of those segments and showed that it was a ratings boost anytime they did their segment on Imus, they pitched that to Cumulus, and they ended up getting the 9 to Midnight show mm-hmm. on Westwood One.
Yeah.
And did that, and he was wildly successful with that show, and he went on from Laura's show to where he is still the vice president of content at Salem to this day, where, you know, at the time he was overseeing Bill Bennett, Dennis Prager, Hugh Hewitt, Michael Medved, all them. Now it's Eric Metaxas, Larry Elder, all these other shows, Dennis Prager still overseeing their stuff, but he got so sick of angry conservatives talking to other angry conservatives about how angry and conservative they are for 3 hours a day on the radio, and he said, you know, the left creates content that hits the American middle and moves them to the left. They create broad, culturally relevant content that appeals to the average person, and through kind of values undertone, if you will, move people on the political spectrum or towards secular humanism on the religious spectrum. NPR is really what he was thinking. And he and Bill Bennett were having a conversation and said, you know, what would National Public Radio sound like if it was done by people who love God and love their country? And, you know, he said, you know, so he got to work and he reverse engineered National Public Radio. And he's like, okay, this is a 501c3 not-for-profit that's connected to a content production distribution platform. They do $350 million a year. $350 million a year, and only 6% of that comes from the government through taxes.
Yeah.
The rest is like-minded philanthropists, universities, corporations, pledge drives. This is the revenue model. It's like, man, that's freaking brilliant. Why aren't we doing this? And K-Love kind of is. I'm not going to get into all these media models and stuff, but you know, shows that. It's like, this is amazing. We're going to do the same thing. We're going to get rid of the government money, but take that same, you know, pie of revenue sources. And he did. And but they not only do they make $350 million a year, they reach 33 million people a week, which is like quadruple what Rush Limbaugh was reaching in his prime.
That's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. Right? Yeah. It's insane. And so he's like, golly, look at what they're doing. And so he really liked the storytelling aspect of like This American Life,
mm-hmm.
full sound design storytelling. And he said, what we're going to do is we're going to create American Private Radio, which will be the 501c3 not-for-profit. We're going to produce a show called Our American Stories. And it is telling the story of America to Americans each and every night. It's a phenomenal show. It's very mm-hmm. This American Life sounding, full sound design. But, you know, you would tell the story of Tom Petty. And Tom Petty's telling his own story, talking about growing up in Florida, what his dad was like, getting his first record deal. But he's also like, it, like in between, you'd hear his songs and stuff. And you're just hooked. Like, yeah, everyone doesn't love Tom Petty. So you're hooked. And then all of a sudden it'll fade. And then it would go to the next story. And it would just be like the seamless transition. It would be Dr. Larry Arnn telling the story of Thomas Jefferson writing the Declaration of Independence in 2 weeks when he was 33 years old. Mm-hmm. And when he signed his own death warrant. Like, that's freaking amazing.
You know? Right.
So there was that. You know, that was kind of the premise of the show. And I had the success at USA Radio Networks. He discovered me and calls me. He says, Brian, I want you to come work for me. And I'm like, well, I was pretty forward.
Yeah. You know?
And you know, getting a call from Lee's like getting a call from Steinbrenner to go play for the Yankees. Like, this is – so you mentioned USA being big time, no. But Lee, yes, right?
Yeah.
And so I get that call. He lives in Oxford, Mississippi, so I went and saw him in Oxford, Mississippi, and I got, let me tell you about my family niece.
So you got to lead with that.
Yeah.
You know, let me tell you that story real quick.
Correct. And I'm thinking he's going to run for the hills, you know. And he and his wife, we were at a cafe in Oxford, Mississippi, and they were choked up listening to the story. And he's like, man, you're the exact person I want working for me.
Yeah.
And so he said, I want you to help me grow my show. And I said, okay. I said, but here's the deal, Lee. I don't want to grow people's radio products for the rest of my life. I want to learn the business. I will help you grow your show, but I want you to teach me everything you know. And he's like, laughs. He's like, all right, kid. You grow my show, I teach you what I know. And we shook hands. And for the next 4.5 years, I sat at his feet learning everything I possibly could about the media industry. Unbelievable. Content production, distribution, syndication, nonprofit, you know, revenue, for-profit revenue, sales, fundraising, I mean, you name it. And he was on 80 stations when I started, and I took him to 330 stations. And we did a deal with Premier and iHeart, which is as big as it gets in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But since we're partnered with Cumulus, it's about equal to a Westwood One Cumulus
deal. Right, 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 right.
But, you know, doing a deal with Julie Talbot and, you know, Premier and iHeart, it's as big as it gets. And I mean, I didn't go do the deal, but, like, I plowed the ground to make that deal possible.
Mm-hmm.
He went in and closed it. But that was it. And so iHeart took over distribution. And once iHeart takes over distribution, that was my job, was distribution sales. And so I'm, you know, it was July 2020 when this deal firmed up, and I ended up, Lee introduces me to Bernie Marcus, who's one of the four founders of Home Depot, which is crazy, right? So you're starting to think about where the story's going.
This is wild, wild.
And so Bernie Marcus is one of the four founders of Home Depot based out of Atlanta, and he had a bunch of groups trying to get Trump reelected. And so he had like probably 13 or 14 different groups dedicated to helping Trump and all the down ballot Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a media driven get out the vote effort that they wanted to do. And it was working with Sean Hannity, Dan Bongino. I mean, all these guys, and you understand media, so I can kind of explain it, where we were going to write the copy and basically just buy ad space, like at a negotiated rate, because we were going to do such a massive media buy, and we would write the copy. And then Sean Hannity would be saying the same thing as Dan Bongino is, but Ben Shapiro is, everyone from the Premier host to the Westwood One host to the podcasters to everybody was all going to be reading the same copy that Lee was writing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Had to raise $6 million, and I had some fundraising experience from working for Lee. We went and raised the $6 million, which was crazy to raise $6 million. And then we executed the strategy July to November, blood, sweat, and tears, 80 hours a week, hardest I've ever worked in my entire life. And it came down to November, and I'm one of those crazy tinfoil hat people that thinks the election was stolen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
100%, baby. 100%.
And so I watched that happen, and I just became disenfranchised with national media, national fundraising, national politics.
Yeah.
I felt like fixing Washington, D.C. was like trying to squirt out the sun with a water pistol.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like we can't do it. We don't have that kind of horsepower. And so I went to church shortly after that, and my pastor started preaching on localism. Fathers Fix Your Family. Families Being Church. Churches Make Up Community. Community City. City County. County State. This is the winning strategy. So I went home and prayed with my wife and said, okay, God, how can I use my gifts, talents, abilities, resources, relationships to make a difference for my people in place here in Alabama, where you have me? And a week later, Caleb Crosby calls me from the Alabama Policy Institute. I hadn't talked to Caleb in a year, was not friends with Caleb. We knew each other. We'd met a couple times, but, you know, this is wild. He just calls me out of the blue.
Yeah.
Hey, I know you're a radio guy. We've got a guy who's getting a radio show in Huntsville, who's our chief policy officer. Can you help us figure out how we need to do this show? And I'm like, sure. And I basically just give him a free consultation. Spend like an hour on the phone with him. Sell your inventory for this. You're going to have to cover that, blah, 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 blah. And at the end of the call, he says, you know what we need as much, if not more, than a radio show in Huntsville is a statewide, state-focused news and multimedia company to take out AL.com. I was like, I'll do it. And that was it. And that was the beginning of it. And so he said, put together a mission, vision, plan, and a budget. And I did. I wrote it out. Spent a ton of time. Mission, vision, plan, budget. Drove up to Birmingham. I live in Wetumpka. Drove up to Birmingham and sat down with he and Carl Jones, who was the chief operating officer there, and sat down with him and presented my plan, and they loved it, and we got to work, and we went and raised a bunch of philanthropic capital. We began as part of the Alabama Policy Institute. They kind of operate as my training wheels. Like, I've never ran a business before, you know. And so they helped me kind of, you know, get oriented and made sure that I was crossing my T's and dotting my I's. And once I felt comfortable with that, we separated and turned into our own entity. And as I said earlier, now the second largest statewide publication in the state.
Dude, AL.com wishes they had a story like this. Yeah. They just wish. What a bunch of losers. Yeah, yes. taking out AL.com, I think, would have been something we would have always welcomed. I
mean, AL.com sucks.
They absolutely suck.
But what they do, and again, you got me on a long-form podcast, bro. I can talk.
You're good.
And what they do, though, is the left buys institutions because they understand the power of culture to shape policy, right? Yep. They understand that politics and public policy is downstream from culture. This is my open in my podcast with it always goes through, but politics and public policy is downstream from culture, and they know that media drives culture, and so they wait for institutions to get like devalued and they go in and buy them. And so what happened in Alabama, and it was everywhere across the country in 2007, all the car dealership ads, mortgage ads, left print journalism and went Craigslist, Facebook, Google. When that happened, it gutted all of the print journalism, like it gutted their revenue. So they had to fire all these reporters, Birmingham News, Mobile Press Register, Huntsville Times. They had to fire all these reporters. So if you think about it from a standpoint of like there's 10,000 law enforcement officers in the state of Alabama. If they fired 9,000 of them, okay, there'd be 1,000 left. What do you think would happen to crime? It'd freaking go through the roof. Well, when you fired all these journalists, right, like government corruption goes through the roof. And yeah. we've graphed this out. When a legitimate news publication goes under, the cost of doing government goes like skyrockets.
Yeah.
Okay. And so this is what happened, and it happened all over the place. And when money left print journalism, conservatives left print journalism because conservatives, it's a bless and a curse to be conservative. We care about money. We want to see returns. We want to see profits. Like that's what moves us and motivates us. And so they leave. And so now here's the Birmingham News, the Mobile Press Register, and the Huntsville Times, these once prestigious, incredible institutions of journalism, investigative journalism, reporting that the entire state was blessed and benefited from these institutions. And they have these mastheads that are trusted for hundreds of years that my daddy read it, my granddaddy read it, and his dad before him, right? Type of trust. And so the left, this group out of New Jersey and New York, Advanced Media, Newhouse Publications, comes in and buys up these three major publications under the Alabama Media Group, and then creates a website to disseminate the content, and it's AL.com. And
it's
they,
these northern values coming through an Alabama website.
Yeah.
Or Alabama Coastal. Publications.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you know, good dirty rednecks are trying to raise the Klan again. You bitter clingers bitterly clinging to your guns and your Bibles. How dare you? The freaking editor they just hired. Did you see this? The editor they just hired is this black guy that came from Gannett. Gannett's another big, you know, liberal public news publication group that owns USA Today.
Yeah.
And a bunch of small town publications all over the country. And he is has a lawsuit filed against him from his time at Gannett because he put in a hiring policy that you couldn't hire any more white males in management. Right, that's the editor in chief they chose for Alabama.
You know, we should really like make a concerted effort just to shame every white person at AL.com, especially that guy that draws the awful cartoons. What's his name?
J.D. Crow. He did one of me. That's what I knew I made.
Oh it. Man, that when is I, when, the worst.
Now it wasn't me personally that was made into it, but it was the Burn the Freaking Books. I don't know if you saw that story. AL.com did this huge like investigative piece about what's going on in the libraries. It's like, well, there's porn that's grooming children into questioning right. their gender. That's what's going on. I could have saved you friggin' 8,000 words.
Yeah.
You know, but I was at this, the Prattville Library people invited me to do this, you know, forum or whatever to talk about this stuff. And I'm like, I don't really know what there is to talk about. There's porn in the children's section.
Yeah.
And it's not just porn. It's pornographic with the intent to groom and get children to question
Correct.
Their gender. Very common, basic stuff. And, you know, because of everyone's, like, First Amendment and all these, like, and again, like, I love the Constitution, but, like, at some point, sometimes you just got to back up and look at what's going on and just be normal.
You got to, yeah, protect children.
Correct. Like, it's all this other stuff. And so... They're like, well, we think that maybe we should move the books from the children's section to the teenage section. I'm like, burn the freaking books. Because that's what the left is always saying, right? They're like, are you a book burner? And I'm like, I don't know. What kind of books are they?
Yeah,
like, you know, and like that insult you're going to hurl at me. And I'm like, well, I'm not a book burner. I'm not one of those. I'm like, burn those freaking books, dude. Burn the books.
Taken what was once. Take the example of you're a racist.
Yeah.
All right. That used to be kind of a hurtful thing to call somebody, because nobody wants to be known as a racist.
Sure.
But now if somebody calls you a racist, it's like, whatever, that means nothing. That word holds no more value.
And it's basically, if you're in our world and someone hasn't called you racist, you know, and it's like, why am I racist? Well, because you're white and you have seven children. you're trying to protect the white hegemony. And it's like,
yeah, you're trying to put more
homeschooling
white people
too,
in the world.
You're homeschooling too? Disc. And it's like,
all these white children with your white curriculum in your home. Oh, man. That's crazy. If AL.com is spending time attacking your outlet, you're doing something
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest ones y'all got going on, or I say y'all, the state of Alabama has got going on right now, is this deal up in Huntsville.
Sure.
I think I dubbed it the Space Gay whenever I started, before we started the show. And... I have not really covered this story on my radio show because everybody else was kind of talking. I don't do a whole lot of state issues, which is why it's good for me to have you on the show, on the podcast. But what I understand on its face is you've got Space Camp in Huntsville, a counselor in a female dorm.
Correct.
Is transgender.
Has a penis.
Has a pee-pee. And that nobody knew it until when? Did a parent tip him off or what?
I think they were all aware that he had a penis.
Everybody.
But the parents whose children were going to be staying there became aware, right? And so we were aware of it. And then obviously Coach Tuberville put out a thing pretty quickly. And we being, you know, responsible journalists, we had to look into call question and all that stuff before we put the story up. But we, you know, heard about it, immediately got to work on it, and kind of exposed the fact that this guy who was going to be entrusted with all these girls was, in fact, I mean, it was a guy, right, that thinks he's a girl.
It's kind of a big deal.
It's kind of a big deal. and again, it goes back to, you know, when everyone's like, I can't believe you would do that. He has feelings, too. And it's like, yeah, but... The girls, like, what about the girls in the camp? Like, what about them? Like, does no one care about them? Why does that not the number one priority is the safety of those children?
Right, and really outside of that, Tony Gump, I just sent you an email, if you'll grab that. It's a tweet that I found earlier today. This turns out to be much bigger than just somebody being trans and like, oh, you're a transphobe. You just don't like them because they're trans. When you go to this person's social media, click that top left picture. Now go back one. The four squares. Yeah, click that top left square. Yeah. This is some of the social media posts from this person, allegedly, from what I understand.
Allegedly.
It says, Nova loves you is the trans's Twitter handle. And it says things like, I don't know who needs to hear this, but there's no rule that says you can't do a phone interview while you're still depressed ass is half naked in bed. Another one says, you know, for all the bigots that keep saying they're shoving this trans agenda down our throats, I have to laugh. Because if I was shoving something down your throat, you wouldn't have a choice but to shut the F up. Click that. Click the next button over to the far right. Let's see. What's go to the next one. Something about Femboy. Years ago, I ordered 10 of these stickers from blah, blah, blah. And today I placed the last one in my collection. Next week, I start teaching kids about space. I hope they see my notebook and feel proud to be themselves in this big universe. It says gender is a universe. One more. There's a drawing of a what looks like a furry with a penis sticking out. I saw several of these and they're very graphic things that this person is posting, obviously showing that they are a perv, you know, and not ashamed of it. So why would this person not push that off on the kids? Yeah,
I think I just had a metaphor pop into my brain. Occasionally that happens. I'm like, this is like this or it's like that.
Yeah.
So when people enter our country illegally, they are by definition criminals. Mm-hmm. Immediately, the moment they cross the border, they are now illegal, which makes them criminals. They're breaking the law, their very presence here. And so they're like, well, how do you know they're criminals? Because they broke the law to get
correct
here. They're immediately criminals the moment they're here. And I'm the same way when it goes to this kind of stuff. If there is a guy who believes he's a girl and is posting the stuff like we're seeing, he is automatically a pervert.
Right.
Like, every man is a potential pervert in a dorm full of girls, okay? Like, every single man, like, no man should be trusted in there.
Yeah, it's inappropriate.
It's inappropriate for a man to be in a girl's dorm. Like that is something that no man needs to be doing. Specifically, a man who thinks he's a woman and posts this weird stuff about shoving people down people's throats so they can shut the F up. Like,
right,
that dude for sure doesn't need to be near anybody's daughters, right?
Well, and there's so many out there that we think about this thing that happened at Planet Fitness recently where you have some guy was in the women's locker room and he was shaving and some lady said something about it and they canceled her membership.
Yeah.
This dude's like, well, I'm trans, I'm LGBTQ, whatever. And, you know, there's guys out there that are pretending to be girls just for the sake of being able to get in those dorms.
Sure.
Or in those locker rooms. But what kills me is how they continue to say things such as, you know, you have to accept these people for who they are. I'm like, you can't even accept you for who you are. You can't even accept your own gender. Why do I have to accept this make-believe thing?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're an adult, do what you want to do, but the line gets drawn at the kids.
Yeah, and also at me having to play along.
Yes, not right? Playing along.
I've never played along from the very, very beginning. You know, it was like, oh, it's Caitlyn Jenner. That's Bruce with a penis.
Yeah, it's Bruce.
That's Bruce. That is not Caitlyn, right? And so that's my feeling on it. But
the other big story that you guys had going on, which really got y'all some clicks because everybody all over the world started picking this up.
Sure.
Was the Smith Station. The Smith Station's right around Auburn, right?
Yeah.
This pastor, Bubba Copeland, everybody probably knows the story by now, but he's a pastor at a small church.
No, it's First Baptist Church of Phoenix
City. So it was
City.
A big church.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like monster mega church in Birmingham with 50,000 people or whatever, but it was, I mean,
for that area,
First Baptist Church in Phoenix City, it was sizable. I don't know if it's 500, I don't know if it's 1,000, but it was enough.
So this guy's longtime pastor, he ends up being found out about. He's had some weird things going on where he's dressing up as a girl and doing some sexual stuff online and writing some weird homoerotic novels. I can't even say it.
Words.
And he ends up getting outed. Now, how did, because you were the guys that broke the story.
Sure.
How did that come about in the first place? Like, y'all don't send your reporters to Smith Station every day.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
No, and so, I mean, just like, you know, police, like, you work off leads more than you do actually, you know, seeing stuff, though we're always looking.
Right.
We're always patrolling, but more often than not, it comes from. And so then you develop people who provide you good leads, and then you become trusted. And so mm-hmm. this was actually a trusted source who brought us the story and said, hey, you know, there's this guy, he's, you know, and not only, you know, was he, you know, doing some of these sexual exploits, but there's also some weird land deals with him as the mayor, you know, buying property that belongs, like, I just, it was the whole thing.
A lot of
shadiness. A lot of shadiness going on, and but as we looked into it, as Craig, our reporter, began to look into it, the graphic nature of some of the, you know, trans porn, if that's what you want to call it, but it's like, it's a public figure, it's a double public figure, a pastor and a mayor,
so that's right.
Two public figures, on public forums, Reddit and other public forums, porn sites and stuff that are all public, you don't have to have passwords or anything to get into, public, double public figure on public forums, posting pictures of himself dressed in drag or as a trans person. The thing that really caught our attention was there was a meme that he posted, and in the meme it had pictures of children, and he made it look like the children, like it was like this 12-year-old boy, and then the other girl, it was ended up like a 14-year-old girl, and it made it look like the boy trans to the girl. And on the meme it said, I don't want to get this wrong. It said, get the shots. No, take the shots, get the implants, become the whore.
Mm.
And then I had pictures of these children transitioning. Well, then when we post the story, the dad of those children calls, like, please take my children's picture. Like, those were children from the community.
Wow.
And he's like, you know, going, you know, on social media and putting them on his, you know, his tranny, you know, fantasy stuff or whatever. And so that meme mixed with some of the graphic nature, the photos mixed with the homoerotic fiction that he was writing, that was, it was just horrendous, dude.
This is a sick dude that just happened to get some power. I mean, I sit here and think about the process. Like, this had to be who he was before he was the mayor.
Sure.
This had to be who he was before he was the pastor.
Yeah, and he was a youth pastor before he was a pastor.
Oh, my God.
I wonder what happened there.
And so this is all horrendous, and this guy sounds like a really awful person, but once the story comes out, who's the bad guy? Well, Brian Dawson's the bad guy.
Correct.
1819's the bad guy. How dare you?
But
when you guys became the villains of this story, did that happen before? Because everybody knows kind of how this plays out. So this mayor and pastor ends up committing suicide. Did y'all catch heat before that happened?
We caught some heat, and it was basically like, why are you doing this? Da 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 da. And, you know, whatever. But I mean, it became national news really quick, and because it was national news, the cops went to do a wellness check on him. Hey, how are you doing? And so they saw his car, and so they flipped their lights on to do a wellness check, and he takes off.
Mm.
Right, which is a fact worth noting.
Yeah.
So he takes off. The chase comes to an end, and he gets out of the car and shoots himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, we find out about that. This is tragic, whatever. But, yeah, that's when the liberal media basically, you know, if the amount of times I was told that I have blood on my hands and, you know, all this other stuff. And it's like, look, man, people said, you know, and it got crazy. I mean, so we were front page news on the New York Times, Washington Post, Guardian, Daily Beast. I mean, you name it. The amount of hit pieces that were written about us in these major national publications, we were front page news and some New Delhi publication and some United Kingdom publication. I mean, it was crazy. And for 3 weeks, it was nonstop. And so there was, you know, they were taking pictures of my kids and putting it on social media with my home address underneath, talking about be ashamed if something happened to your kids and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Threatening to kill my family. Same thing happened to Jeff Poore. Same thing happened to Craig Monger. These type of threats. And like, you don't know if one of these people is deranged enough to do something, you know? So it was
nuts. I would have got on the internet, but like, y'all don't know how crazy Brian Dawson is. You might not want to show up to his house, cuz.
That might have worked in my favor.
That dude's seen some stuff.
Yeah. But so that happens, and, you know, but afterwards someone asked me, like, would you do it again? I said, in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, we know that by exposing, again, if I was a member of that church, would I want to know that that was my pastor? If I was a citizen of that town, would I want to know that was my mayor? Because another one of the things that came out, one of the homoerotic novels he wrote was about him transitioning into this real woman who had a hair salon either in Phoenix City or Smith Station. It was her real name, and it was the name of her salon in this fiction, where he was going to kill her and transition into her identity so that he could have sex with her husband.
Mm.
Right? And it's like, if your mayor's writing stuff like that about you, imagine.
That's a red flag.
Yeah.
Man.
Imagine. You know, what's the guy's name? Randall Woodfin.
Yeah.
You look in his journal, and he's you know, coming after Andrew.
But let's not completely dismiss that. That's possible. This is crazy, because the media, the same media that spent their time attacking you, and we actually got a clip from NBC that was talking about this. These same media outlets and these same reporters that were so upset by this would have been all over this if they got the story first. They would say small town backwards, Alabama mayor and pastor, because they don't miss an opportunity to attack Christians and attack Republicans. This would have been a perfect hypocrite, Bubba Copeland over here dressing like a woman but trying to preach the gospel. And so they would have eaten that up, and they would have he'd have been on Saturday Night Live. Stephen Colbert would have been talking about it, but you guys picked up the story. He blows his brains out, and then all of a sudden, oh, we loved Bubba Copeland. He was just a trans guy like the rest of us. And it's like, no, he was a sick dude. Here, but play this NBC clip real quick.
Let's take it down south where tonight a small town in Alabama is mourning the loss of their mayor, who died of an apparent suicide just days after a conservative news site published a story that showed alleged photos of him on social media, allegedly wearing women's clothes and makeup. They claim he led a secret life and labeled himself on sites as a transgender curvy girl. NBC News is not going to show those pictures. The news site did not respond to our request for comment. Copeland is also the pastor at a local church where he addressed the two articles just 2 days before he died. Listen.
I apologize for any embarrassment caused by my private and personal life. I have nothing to be ashamed of. A lot of things that were said were taken out of context.
I want to bring in Morgan Chesky, who's covering this one for us tonight. Morgan, Mayor Copeland had been the mayor of this town, Smith's Station, for years. What else do we know about him and how this happened?
How highly they speak of him.
Hallie, elected back in 2016, we know that Smith Station, a town of about 5,000 people, and when Bubba Copeland was elected, it was reported that he really wanted to try to grow this small community, bring new business in. It was a place that he recently described as a modern-day Mayberry, and by all accounts, he was successful during his tenure as mayor, and you mentioned, Hallie, he wasn't just the mayor of
course,
Smith Station.
Of course, this is the picture. He was also okay, so... You see the glowing review that they're giving of, oh, man, he's been here since 2016. He was growing the city. Oh, look, he's with Donald Trump. You know, and they act as if they wouldn't have been all over this. This one, personally, is my favorite. This is the Young Turks. This is when you know you've really rubbed people the wrong way, when the Young Turks are talking about you.
The mayor tragically took his own life days after a conservative outlet published photos of him wearing women's clothing. Bubba Copeland was also a pastor and the mayor of Smith Station, Alabama. Now, Craig Monger is the fearmonger in question
fearmonger.
Here.
Oh, fearmonger there.
1819 News, that's the conservative publication. Smith Station's mayor operated social media accounts as a transgender woman under the pseudonym Brittany Blair Summerlin. Craig Monger interviewed Copeland, who said that the posts were ways of getting rid of stress. Now, after the interview, Copeland promptly
deleted the accounts. That's a weird way to get rid of stress.
And asked them not to be made public due to his family and his position as a pastor. But of course, the publication made those images public anyway. And out of respect for Bubba Copeland and his family, we are not going to show you those images, and we are not going to do anything that would, you know, uplift the disgusting like reporting here that took place, because there was really no public interest in reporting this. Okay,
none?
Bubba Copeland was not some bigot who went around judging the lifestyles of others. He wasn't someone who wanted to pass legislation against transgender people. That wasn't who he was. So you can't use that cover to justify what this publication did. And it's a right-wing publication whose editor-in-chief used to work over at Breitbart. This is a publication that Steve Bannon called fantastic. Yeah. Now, after 1819 published the photos, Bubba Copeland addressed the church about it. We've got that video. Let's watch.
Okay, we don't have to watch that again. We've already seen Bubba once. So you see this glowing review of Bubba Copeland. We are not going to show you the pictures. By the way, thank you. We don't need to see them again. Yeah. But this awful news outlet had the audacity to report the news of something awful that was, and they, of course, they omit all the disgusting, you know, pedophilic behavior that was going on within this. Why does it always seem the left ends up defending pedophilia?
I call this kind of the trans George Floyd.
Yeah, you know? Kind of is.
It's that same mentality. And again, I thought the same thing. If the folks at AL.com would have got to this, you know, got the story before us, it mm-hmm. would have been, you know, it would have been, you know, conservative right wing yep. pastor, you know, da 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 da. And that's the other thing that was real wild is the one thing that we get hit with all the time from the left is how come you don't expose pastors? How there's all this sexual stuff going on in these churches and you don't expose pastors. Well, we did, and then we were...
Then y'all got bit out of shape about it.
And so, you know, but at the end of the day, we're going to continue to do what we think is right, and that, you know, that Breitbart editor that they talked about, Jeff Poor, mm-hmm. there's very few people with better news judgment than him. They're just, like, he's just good. Sometimes I'd like him to go a little bit farther, on, not necessarily in this area, but, like, on other things, and he's actually wiser and has decades of experience and can explain to me, like, well, no, this is why not, or this, you know, so... He's very, very good. I trust him completely, and we're just going to continue to do what we think is in the best interest of the people of Alabama and the citizens of these towns. And at the end of the day, it goes back to if your children were in a youth group at that church, would you want to know?
Mm-hmm.
And if you were a citizen and your mayor, who again went and for sure, you know, on his campaign speeches, had the shotgun over his shoulder with the church steeple in the background and the John Deere tractor to go get them conservative votes, you know, and was doing this stuff, would you want to know? And they never talk about, they always say, he was dressed in women's clothes. Like, and again, if that was the story, if he dressed up in his wife's clothes in his living room, and that was all there was to the story, it's probably not a story.
Right.
But it was so far beyond that, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's egregious, but, you know.
It shows how dishonest these people are. And by the way, I want to confirm Jeff is a great guy. There was one time where I was complaining on the radio about how I couldn't find anywhere to stream the Andrew Breitbart movie called Hating Breitbart.
Yeah.
And Jeff, who was with Breitbart at the time, actually had them mail me a DVD copy of that movie so wow. I could have it. I still have it to this day. So Jeff's a good dude. I've known him for
what was that
a little
movie
bit.
About?
It was just Breitbart's life from like 2010 to it was like a documentary kind of thing.
Did it talk about how he died?
No. I think they finished it before he died. I think he probably got hit with a heart attack gun. I mean, they took.
That's why
there's
I like
no.
You guys.
There's no doubt in my mind they
I
took
like
him out.
Guys.
That's what I put my money on. Yeah.
He got the Seth Rich treatment. You yeah. know these guys. I mean. It's the way it goes.
But
I'm known
if people
as,
can't wake up to this stuff, this is why we can't win is because everybody wants to believe that, like, oh, that no, this wouldn't happen. No. It's like, no, it's happening all the time. Who was, again, here, I'll go full tinfoil hat here for you guys.
Now, you ain't going to out tinfoil us. We're all going to be on the same page.
Who, I can't think of his name. I can Google it, I'm sure, and you guys probably know the name. Kelly Loeffler's staffer that was dating Governor Kemp's daughter. Okay.
I don't remember that.
Man, well, I'm going to have him look it up. I'm going to do the Joe Rogan where you point to the guy. I need
a
guy
on
my podcast.
That's the beauty of this, yeah. And Tony
like Kelly Loeffler?
Kelly Loeffler. She was the United States Senator that lost in the 2020 election
right.
through the same fashion that Trump lost. Loeffler yeah. aide.
When Georgia just went blue all of a sudden. Except Brian Kemp. Brian
oh, yeah,
Kemp
I
was
see
the
it.
One Republican came out.
You talking about the 20 dies in the crash?
Yeah, and it was
what's her name? Yeah, click that
the
article.
The guy's name was like Hudson or I don't know why I can't think of his name.
Loeffler campaign staffer 20 dies in South Georgia crash.
And so anyway, it was so this is when Governor Kemp was talking about doing all these audits and everything and then all of a sudden Governor Kemp's daughter's boyfriend who's an aide for Loeffler said he died in a car crash. Well, then it flashes to footage of the car crash, and it looks like a missile was shot, like, from a drone and just, like, blew the car to smithereens, and there's,
wow.
like, a pit and flames and all this other stuff. Harrison Deal, that's his name. Oh, Harrison yeah. Deal. You can go to YouTube and put Harrison Deal crash.
That's crazy. Yeah, see if you can pull up that video. We'll just look at that car real quick before we get out of here. Now I'm fascinated by this. Because that's where we're at. I'm on the station. I'm known as the guy that's kind of out here. Everybody else tries to keep it inside of a respectable like, don't want to seem crazy realm, but I'm the one that, like, I'll if y'all want to think I'm crazy, that's fine. I'll go ahead and go out here. I've already gone too far as it is.
So, trying to find it here.
Yeah, what did we say his name? Harrison Deal? Yeah, Harrison Deal car crash or something?
There was it wasn't the news coverage. It was like someone who drove by and they may have taken
there
it off.
Go, here
second
we go.
One, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you see it? Just a little fender bender.
I think you gotta go. Is this it?
This is it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Little fender bender.
No volume.
That is that's not a fender bender.
Yeah.
Go.
I mean, I guess cars can get in wrecks and set on fire. I mean, that does happen.
That's a little extreme.
That's a little extreme, is it not?
And yeah, go back one click backwards and look at that second video that was on that list. It looked like it might have had a different angle on it. Try that one. Yeah.
I don't think it does.
We are beginning with developing news involving a deadly crash in Chatham County.
News 3 has learned a campaign worker for Senator Kelly Loeffler has died and be closed until
look at that.
As investigators continue to work the scene.
We have no idea what happened. It's an absolute coincidence that Governor Kemp's daughter's boyfriend, who worked for Kelly Loeffler, who's also trying to win an election right now. We don't know how he died. Apparently, he bumped into the rail. And
everything going on in Georgia, Brian Kemp's on every bit of it.
Yeah.
Every bit of that's the argument they like to make is, well, if you think Georgia's being stolen, I mean, how does Brian Kemp win? Because Brian Kemp's in on it.
Yeah.
All he's got to do is keep his mouth shut and pretend like they had the safest election in history.
And who's that Secretary of State, too, who's in on it?
Raffensperger.
Yeah.
Right?
Do you guys know Greg Phillips?
I was going to ask you about that. I saw him on your show.
He's one of my best friends, yeah.
I would love to have him on this
podcast. Yeah, he'll come in.
We probably could only post it on Rumble and not YouTube, but yeah. I'd love to have him in here and talk to you.
If they let me stay on YouTube, I wouldn't care.
We just try to, like, when we talk about certain things, such as, you know, the pandemic, we try to use Pig Latin for YouTube. So we call it Ovid K or the Axine Vay. Or, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Coof or whatever.
Udklot Bay.
Yeah. Yeah. The Udklot Bay. So, we would love to have him on the show, man. That guy's fascinating. He and I went and watched, as soon as 2000 Mules came out, him and I went to the theater together and watched it with our wives.
Yep.
Yeah, no, I mean,
I was in the back of the theater taking pictures with my phone for show prep the next day.
Yeah, he spends a lot of time in Birmingham, so man. I don't think it'd be a problem to get him in here.
That would be awesome. Let's hook that up. Well, listen, man, I appreciate you taking the time to come. This is, I don't think anybody so far has come on this podcast and told a more fascinating story than you have.
True.
I really mean that. That's good stuff, and I can't wait for people to see it, which we'll have to have you back in here because we're going to have to just do a whole full-blown tinfoil hat show.
Yeah.
Because it was just now starting to get good. Now I got to get out of here.
Jeff loves it when I do that, too, by the way. He's just like,
and I just got to say, for the record, your wife's awesome. I like good investors that buy good stocks
That's
at the lowest value.
She is a savvy investor indeed.
Yeah. Smart. Well, cool, man. Thanks again, Brian. 1819news.com?
Yeah, go to 1819news.com. You can go there if you want to support us financially. There's a button at the top that says Become a Member. Click that. Membership starts as little as $5 a month. With that, you get access to overtime segments, behind-the-scene content, and you get cool merch. We've got the greatest hats.
Yeah.
But if not that, if you're not signed up to the newsletter, you are absolutely missing out. Our newsletter drives the news cycle in the state of Alabama. I mean, people that hate me, people that love me, tell me the same thing. You know, either I hate you guys, you're da da da, but it's the first thing I read every morning. Or man, you guys are doing a great job. It's the first thing I read every morning at 5:45 in the morning. So that newsletter, I always say, there's two things that happen every morning, and you may actually be able to confirm this. At 5:45, there's legislators on their knees praying to God they're not in the newsletter. And then there's radio show hosts that get up to do their show prep, and they grab the newsletter, right?
That's right.
And so we're, you know, holding accountable and driving the news cycle.
Good stuff. What about the podcast?
Yeah, 1819 News, the podcast. As I mentioned, I'm not on the YouTubes. They don't like me.
Yeah.
And so you can go Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Rumble, any podcast app, and you know, you never know what you're going to get on that podcast. I've interviewed Gene Stallings, John Hanna, John Croyle, Alabama football Bear Bryant. I've had Greg Phillips. I've had, you know, just whoever, just interesting people. I have them come on, and there's usually an Alabama angle to it. But, you know, I mean, Steve Marshall comes on every 3 months, the attorney general here, Will Ainsworth, the lieutenant governor, comes on every 3 months. So just a cornucopia of goodness.
That's awesome.
1819 News, the podcast.
Well, cool. Again, appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Tony Gump, for everything you do, my friend.
No problem.
Yep. You're the man. You're the man as well, Brian. We will get you on here again soon, my friend.
Awesome.
All right. Until next time, see you, cuz.